This is WCNO Palm City, the good news station.
Welcome to the Religious Liberty Report, a weekly news briefing on religious liberty news, a program hoping to educate, encourage, support, and equip you, our listeners, on important issues of our day, but always approaching the issues from a biblical worldview.
Welcome to the Religious Liberty Report, a Christian legal ministry advocating for religious liberties, freedom of conscience. Thank you for the honor of addressing you on the Religious Liberty Report. For me, an inspiration, an honor, to bring you this weekly report. The church is called to be the moral, the cultural conscience of the nation. We can't, we mustn't stay on the sidelines and let the culture just do its own thing. Here on the report, we're hoping to help equip you with tools to take your faith to the culture so that we can better articulate our Christian worldview in a way that is courteous, kind, winsome, yet bold, uncompromising, and committed to God's word as our guide. The idea is not to win debates, but to win hearts, minds, and souls. Today we'll be covering the history of modern Israel. Why is there no Palestinian state? No Palestinian entity has ever accepted any sort of partition plan with regards to the land of Israel. Why? Let's start in 1919 with the Balfour Declaration suggesting that a Jewish state or a Jewish national homeland should be established in Israel. But under Arab pressure and continued attacks on Jews in Palestine and British soldiers, in 1937, there was established a commission called the Peel Commission, P-E-E-L, which proposed a partition plan. The result would have been a remnant, rump state. This partition plan would have left, under British rule, a corridor from Jaffa to Jerusalem. That would have been under British rule, and then virtually the entirety of the land of Israel, the modern state of Israel, would have been surrounded by Arab states, ranging all the way in the north from Lake Tiberias all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. It would have resulted in a split Jewish state. In 1937, the proposed partition plan by the Peel Commission. The Jews accepted it. The Arabs rejected it. Moving forward to 1947, a United Nations partition plan after World War II. The British presented before the UN a partition plan in 1947. Again, the result would have been a remnant Jewish state with what they described as indefensible borders. Absolutely indefensible borders. The proposed Jewish state in 1947 would have sliced off not only the Gaza Strip, but a large segment of the south of Israel. Israel would have been left with basically the Negev, a corridor from Tel Aviv to Haifa. Jerusalem would have been an international zone. The West Bank would have been a larger territory than the one we have today. Plus, parts of northern Israel would have been deemed an Arab state, an Arab territory. That was the plan presented in 1947 before the United Nations. Again, the Jews accepted the plan. The Arabs rejected the plan and proceeded to launch an attack in 1948 against the Jews in Palestine. This would have been now the second Arab rejection of a partition plan, followed by a military attack in 1948. And that attack in 1948, well, it ended with Israel controlling slightly more territory than it would have if the Arabs had actually just accepted the UN partition plan of 1947. The map of what happened in 1948 is that attacks from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon all converging on the Jewish communities in Palestine. All those armies simultaneously attacking the nation-state of Israel in 1948. But the nation-state of Israel fought back. The nation-state of Israel in 1948 ended up with control of what looks like what is now called the Green Line borders, sometimes referred to as the pre-1967 borders. Because we have another period of history in Israel, modern Israel, that is the intervening years from 1948 to 1967, when Arabs controlled what would now be the quote-unquote Palestinian state, including Jordan controlling the so-called West Bank. The entire area of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, of course, had no Jews in it. It was controlled by Egypt. There was, at the time, no demand for an independent Palestinian state. In fact, the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, seeking to liberate Palestine, was directed against the State of Israel and founded in 1964. When all of the current quote-unquote borders of the State of Palestine were under Arab control. A State of Palestine has always been a sort of Trojan horse to destroy the State of Israel. That's what it has always been, and that's what it remains today. That is why the Arabs never accepted any sort of partition plan, ever. So after 1948 again, this is when the Arabs, now controlling what is currently called the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, there was no independent Palestinian state, not even one was proposed by Jordan or by Egypt in these intervening years from 1948 to 1967. So then we have the 1967 war. The Arabs, under a pan-Arab movement led by Nasser of Egypt, decided to mobilize. Israel preemptively struck first, struck Egypt. And after the 1967 war, what they call the Six-Day War, Israel ended up with control of the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the Golan Heights in the north, and the Sinai Desert towards the south, all the way up to the Suez Canal. That is the land that Israel ended up winning in the Six-Day War, land that Israel did not want. What we see in the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict is that Arabs routinely reject peace plans, launch war against Israel. And when they lose these wars, they demand land back. It's a constant pattern throughout the 20th century and even into the 21st century. If ever, once a peace plan had been accepted, the Palestinians rejected them. You're tuned into the Religious Liberty Report. Alexander Othon reporting on the history, the modern history of the State of Israel. Reviewing a pattern throughout the 20th century of partition plans followed by wars in the land of Israel. The Six-Day War of 1967 began when, in response to Arab neighbors apparently mobilizing for war, the nation of Israel attacked preemptively in a first strike and destroyed Egypt and Syrian air forces. Israel also defeated Jordanian attack in the north. The war ended with Israel in control of the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, and Jerusalem. All this happening on the morning of June 5th, 1967, Israeli planes attacked, decimating the Egyptian Air Force, initiating a conflict which would end 6 days later in a resounding Israeli victory. The war cost approximately 25,000 lives and doubled the size of Israeli territory. Some arguing that God helped Israel win this Six-Day War. of course, there was military genius and bravery that led to victory. But according to reports, first-hand reports, there were numerous miracles as well. Tremendously outmanned, outmaneuvered, outnumbered, the Israeli fighter pilots realized that God's supernatural intervention had secured their victory. Nevertheless, before the war, as armies built up and prepared to strike Israel, there was a grim mood in the nation of Israel. The 3 weeks preceding the Six-Day War was one of dread, shock, fright for the residents of Israel. By that time, in 1967, the country of Israel had close to 2.5 million Jews living in the country, the highest concentration of Jews since pre-Holocaust Eastern Europe. But many were pessimistic in Israel in 1967, as armies built up and prepared to attack Israel. Israel troops were vastly outnumbered, 275,000 Israeli defense forces compared to 456,000 soldiers from the combined Iraqi, Syrian, Jordan, and Egyptian armies. The Arab forces also had better weaponry, military equipment. They boasted more than double the amount of tanks and close to four times the amount of combat aircraft. So again, the weeks before the Six-Day War were dreadful for the people of Israel. However, despite all the prognostications, by the time the war ended, the territory under Israeli control had tripled in size. Jews returned to sites where their ancestors had lived for thousands of years, sites from which waves of terror were launched against them for so many years. The Jewish nation, after the Six-Day War in 1967, miraculously victorious in the face of unbelievable odds. History books reference the Hundred Years' War, the Thirty Years' War, but here, in a matter of 6 short days, the nation of Israel managed to utterly defeat not one but 4 powerful enemies. An incredible sense of pride and spiritual awakening gripped the Jewish people worldwide. You're tuned into the Religious Liberty Report, reporting on modern Israeli history, the 1947 Partition Plan, the 1948 War, the 1967 Six-Day War. Moving forward, just 6 years later, in 1973, the Arabs, this time led by Anwar Sadat of Egypt, decided they were going to launch a surprise attack on Israel. But, as with the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel ended up, again, gaining slightly more territory than it would have had before the Yom Kippur War of 1973. Again, in 1973, the Arabs attempting to destroy the State of Israel with the Yom Kippur War. And again, Israel ending up with more territory than before the conflict. Then, in 1978, we have what became the Camp David Accords, agreements between Israel and Egypt, which were finally signed on September 17, 1978, leading the following year to a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, the first such treaty between Israel and any of its Arab neighbors, brokered by U.S. President Jimmy Carter. Officially titled the Framework for Peace in the Middle East, the agreements became known as the Camp David Accords because the negotiations took place at the U.S. presidential retreat at Camp David, Maryland. Egyptian President Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Begin were awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace in 1978 for their contributions to the agreements. Early in his presidency, President Carter met with the leaders of the Middle East and was especially encouraged by President Sadat of Egypt. Sadat wanted the Israeli-occupied Sinai, which had been taken in the 1973 war, the Yom Kippur War. He wanted it returned to Egypt, as well as peace for his people and a stronger relationship with the United States. The U.S. president also met with Begin, the Israeli premier, who had also recently become prime minister. The U.S. president found him willing to consider peace with the Egyptians. The two leaders accepted President Carter's invitation, and the summit began on September 5, 1978, lasting for 13 days. Egypt and Israel had been at war, a technical status of war, for decades. But the personality differences of the leaders also promised to complicate the dialogue. The Israeli prime minister always dressed in a formal attire, and his manner was very detail-oriented. He was careful about the possible ramifications of the agreements. The Israeli prime minister was also pessimistic about what could be achieved at Camp David. By contrast, the Egyptian president, Sadat, wore fashionable sports clothes. He was relaxed, forthcoming, willing to join in comprehensive negotiations aimed at settling the controversial issues of the Middle East. The result of the Camp David Accords, the entire Sinai returned to Egyptian hands. Under Camp David Accords, Israel had returned to Egypt the entire Sinai. Jimmy Carter, President of the United States, President Anwar Sadat of Egypt, and Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel. Israel giving up the Sinai Desert for an agreement of peace with the Egyptians. Fast forward to the 1990s, the early 1990s, the Oslo Accords. The Oslo Accords agreeing to a certain number of items, a gradual definition of borders for a Palestinian state, predicated on a series of steps being followed, in exchange for a durable peace plan. So in the early 1990s, the Oslo Peace Accords are signed by Israel. On the other side, this time, an arch-terrorist, Yasser Arafat, of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Israel signing the Oslo Accords, many saying foolishly. The Oslo peace plans divided the area into three areas, A, B, and C. The West Bank and Gaza Strip would be Area A under sole Palestinian control. Area B would be a mixed Israeli-Palestinian controlled area, and Area C was Israeli-controlled territories. The Oslo Accords, a set of agreements between Israel and the PLO, establishing a peace process for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, seeking a mutually negotiated two-state solution. Fast-forwarding, again, this time to 2008, when Ehud Barak, a far-left Israeli prime minister, made a proposal. A proposal which would have allowed for the annexation of largely Jewish areas in the West Bank, in return for land swaps that would come from the State of Israel, making up a Palestinian state. There would be a corridor between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, essentially a highway of sorts between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The state of Palestine would then be very close to the borders that had existed between 1948 and 1967, the Green Lines. Except, in the West Bank and the Gaza Strips, those would now be controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Yasser Arafat turned down the deal. He said no, and then walked away, starting the so-called Second Intifada, a violent uprising that ended up killing thousands of Israelis. Why why did Yasser Arafat walk away? A deal that seemed so promising. Why? The reason you walk away from a deal like this is because, again, there is no desire for an actual partition plan on the part of the Palestinians. They want all of it. There is a reason October 7th is popular in Gaza. That is why when European countries say that we recognize a state of Palestine without borders, what they are really recognizing is an attempt to do away with the state of Israel. That is the desire of the governing entities in the Gaza Strip with Hamas. So that was the 2000 Camp David proposal. Then in 2008, Ehud Olmert of Israel trying again, and here too for a sort of centrist figure, making a desperate plan in an attempt to get a peace deal. So he made a 2008 proposal that would have split sovereignty over Jerusalem. Areas of East Jerusalem would have been transferred to the new state of Palestine. There would have been a handover of the entirety of the Gaza Strip to the Palestinians. There would have been a handover of pretty much the entirety of the West Bank to the Palestinians, with land swaps to account for the fact that there are Jews who live in historically Judea and Samaria, areas that were Jewish for literally thousands of years. You can find them in the Bible. And this time, the Palestinians under Yasser Arafat don't even issue a counteroffer. They just walk away from the table and pursue the Intifada. It's not that Israel has not tried to establish borders and peace. It seems more that the Palestinians don't want to define borders because the moment they define borders, they can no longer act as a Trojan horse against Israel. It would seem time and time again that the objective of the Arab states is the destruction of the state of Israel. That they don't simply want a Palestinian state. The reason they don't want a state along partition lines is because at that point, the Trojan horse game is over. A partition plan which they never define, never accept, never specify. And then they suggest they want, quote-unquote, the right of return. A right of return means that any Arab who left or was expelled during the 1947-48 War of Independence, they would be allowed to move back into a state they wish to destroy. That is the idea. You're tuned into the Religious Liberty Report, reviewing modern Israeli history, starting with the Peel Commission partition plan in 1947, followed by the War of Independence in 1948, followed by the 1967 Six-Day War, then the 1973 Yom Kippur War, in the late 1970s, the Camp David Accords, in the early 90s, the Oslo Peace Accords. Then, in 2008, Yasser Arafat turning down another peace plan and calling instead for Intifada. And so we are, so many years later. Now we see countries like Ireland, Spain, Norway, Hungary, Poland calling for the recognition of a Palestinian state. More so, they are currently acknowledging a state of Palestine, believing that Israel is the problem in the region. They don't want to say it out loud, but it seems that so many are perfectly willing to facilitate terrorism in the name of a Palestinian state. These countries calling unilaterally for the establishment of a Palestinian state without Israeli support or consultation. None of these countries acknowledged a state of Palestine before the October 7th massacre. None of them, Ireland, Spain, Norway, Hungary, Poland, and more. Before the October 7th massacre, None of them acknowledged the state of Palestine. But after Hamas commits the atrocity on October 7th, that's when these states, these countries say, okay, now you get a state. Now you deserve a state. Is this going to facilitate peace in the region? Are the Saudis interested in a Palestinian state? Certainly not. They can't say this out loud because much of their population hates the state of Israel, but the Saudi leadership has zero interest in a state of Palestine that would become, no doubt, an Iranian proxy state. Of course the Saudis are not interested in that, which is why the Saudis are openly saying to the Biden administration, please, stop pressuring for a Palestinian state. Stop it. It's a false notion that when a Palestinian state is established, all conflict in the Middle East just goes away. This is absolutely irrational. In fact, the vast majority of conflict in the Middle East, if you're counting dead, wounded, the wars, they have nothing to do with Israel or the Palestinians. Check out the wars in Syria, ISIS, or the takeover of Lebanon by Iran. War is a pretty constant feature of the Middle East, actually, as it turns out. So the world now, in large measure, trying to pressure Israel to make concessions to a terror group in the middle of a war against that terror group, thinking that this would facilitate peace. The notion that there should be a Palestinian state taking control of its own borders is an idea whose time is not here, not now. Absolutely not. Considering that in the recent past, these borders have been used to facilitate terrorism against Israel. Now, a message from a friend of the report, South Florida Bible College and Theological Seminary. Whether you're looking to lead in business, counsel with compassion, run a church, or enrich your spiritual life, the new programs at South Florida Bible College are designed for you. Introducing their Master's in Business Administration, Master's in Mental Health Counseling, and Doctorate in Ministry. At South Florida Bible College, you can aim high with a degree that will set you apart. Explore their diverse range of programs in ministry, theology, business, and counseling, from associate to doctoral levels. All are available both online and on campus, embracing a multicultural and interdenominational community. Identified as one of the top 10 most affordable Bible colleges in the United States, South Florida Bible College will provide quality education at an affordable price. Scholarship opportunities are just a click away. Don't let anything stop you from pursuing your dreams. South Florida Bible College, fully accredited and ready to serve you. Visit them online at sfbc.edu to learn more and apply today. Jesus never promised his followers an easy path. In fact, he told his disciples that the world would hate them. Jesus sent them out as sheep among wolves, and Jesus' words came true in the lives of his apostles, and they're still coming true today in the lives of his followers around the world. Thank you for joining me on the Religious Liberty Report this week. Thank you for the honor of addressing you. For me, personally, an inspiration. Reminding you that the church is called to be the moral, the cultural conscience of the nation. Until next time, God bless you, and God bless America.
Thank you for tuning in to the Religious Liberty Report, a broadcast intended to help equip churches and ministries on how to remain faithful to our mission in a culture that too often